Chapter 2. Trouble is My Business. After graduating from business school in 2001, I returned to China, the place where I had already spent the majority of my career. One reason for feeling drawn back to the place was personal. I was at home in Asia. But there was also a business reason. The global economy was experiencing a tectonic shift, and China's economy was growing like no other. By being there, I felt that I was placing myself at the center of a unique, perhaps even historic, time and place. I had studied Chinese history and language as an undergraduate, and while working towards an MBA at Wharton, I picked up an additional degree in East Asian business. It seemed natural that I would return to China. I had worked there for a number of years, and I even spoke the language. While my background should have prepared me for what was happening in export manufacturing, though, my first real glimpse of the sector suggested that I was in uncharted territory. Exports contributed significantly to the Chinese economic miracle, and yet none of the courses in business school or informal discussions had been about this interesting and important part of the new economy. My classmates had gone off to pursue traditional careers in investment banking, management consulting, or private equity. Coming from a finance background, I had nearly gone down a similar road myself. I wanted to settle in South China, where manufacturing was concentrated, and I was looking for any excuse to get involved. Lucky for me, I didn't have to look all that far. As little as I knew about the production landscape, there were many others who knew even less. Small and medium-sized American importers were streaming into the marketplace, and I was recognized as someone who could help them with their businesses. American importers contacted me, but typically, they only did so after their projects had begun to fall apart, after they had tried and exhausted other options. One reason they waited to ask for help was hubris, but also, as I would later come to understand, Chinese manufacturers were in the habit of making things look easy. In any event, importers who contacted me were often at the end of their rope. They were desperate, and at times I felt like Philip Marlowe from one of Raymond Chandler's detective stories. I had no office with a pebbled glass front door, but clients made their way to me in a similarly random manner. They were looking for help navigating China's mean streets. China was, to borrow a phrase, a world gone wrong, and the work was easy to get. It was just lying around. I had no real job description. I took care of things that needed handling. Typically called on after everything had unraveled, I was asked to put things back on track, to smooth things out, to make things right. Clients called and kept the details to themselves. "I got a job for you," was how it usually started, and without realizing it, I was soon knee-deep. Trouble was my business. I didn't know how long I would work these projects, but I figured it would be a while. My plan was to take whatever work came my way, and rather than deal with one or two large companies, I would assist a larger number of small and medium-sized importers. The idea of diversity held some appeal because I was trying to give myself an education. By getting involved with smaller companies, I could gain from a broader experience involving varied industries. I would have more data points, as it were, and this would offer a better sense of what was going on in this enigmatic but important part of the global economy. Perhaps at the end of it all, I figured, I might even draw a few conclusions. After the soap and shampoo project kicked off, I received a call from Howard, a businessman who dealt in home furnishings. Howard had a project that had gone swimmingly for a number of months, but then his supplier had gone incommunicado. He had never actually been to China himself, which added to his panic. But then he had never felt the need to go there. The business had been effortless. Then, one week, when he was about to place an order, the manufacturer vanished. Howard could not get anyone to return his phone calls or his email messages. This one was a missing persons case. South China manufacturers, for whatever reason, had an aversion to the telephone. They were not particularly good with written forms of communication either. Given the incredible volumes of business these factories were doing with foreign importers of China-made goods, it was a particularly inexplicable quirk. Howard thought the worst when his supplier could not be reached, but I told him not to worry, not just yet. It took a few tries, but I eventually found the owner of the company. While I had succeeded in getting Kevin to the phone, he remained apprehensive and would not offer information regarding Howard's case. At Howard's insistence, I asked Kevin if it would be all right if I stopped by his factory. "Be my guest. How about Tuesday afternoon? Just call me when you're in town. But it's a 2-hour drive. Do you mind if we say Tuesday? Give me a call when you arrive." It was another one of their endearing habits. Manufacturers in South China didn't like to set appointments either. They preferred to be spontaneous. They didn't like to commit to anything. Getting pinned down to a specific time and place meant that an industrialist might miss out on a more important opportunity. It meant the possibility of regret. I hired a car on a Tuesday and traveled to the factory, which was near the city of Chaozhou in the eastern part of Guangdong province, just a couple of hours from the shampoo factory. My driver, who was from Hunan province, had to stop several times to ask for directions, and each time he did, a big cloud of yellow dust caught up with us and covered the taxi. China was home to a number of manufacturing clusters, and Chaozhou focused on the ceramics trade. It was said to have been a center for ceramics for thousands of years because of something to do with the soil in the area. As we drove into town, I noticed that many of the small shops had considerable amounts of fine-grained sand piled up in front of or off to the sides of their places of business. Typically, factories in South China were built along major roads, but the way to Kevin's factory was down a narrow lane. His place was built like a fortress. Instead of the standard accordion-style metal gate that fronted most plants, his had a high brick wall and a gigantic steel door at the entrance. I found the doorbell and rang it. Dogs started barking and kept at it until someone came along and hushed them. Kevin was much friendlier in person than he had been on the phone, and he apologized to me for the long drive. He asked if I had any trouble finding the place. He introduced himself next, saying that he was from Los Angeles. "You're American?" "No, I'm a Chinese." "You moved to the United States?" "No," he said. He enjoyed the exchange and told me about Los Angeles with a sly grin on his face. I told him that I was confused. From what he explained next, I was able to gather that he had only been abroad for pleasure, and not on many occasions either. His accent indicated that he was local Chinese, and he confirmed that he had never actually lived in Southern California. I asked him why he called it home, and he only offered in a dreamy tone, "I love Los Angeles." It was hard for anyone who never spent much time in China to understand the extent to which intention could be mistaken for reality there. Kevin's factory made pottery, and the kind most commonly produced was a faux Italian style that might have been vaguely antique-looking if only it had not been so vividly colored and glazed. Pieces were just coming off the production line, and Kevin showed them to me. One had the word Italianette incorporated into the design. Looking around his factory, I gathered that this new style was suddenly popular in the United States. We worked our way backwards through the processes at the plant, moving from the area where the pieces were finished to the section where workers were painting the dried pots by hand. The operation was paint by numbers. Girls who appeared too young to work sat at wooden benches and patiently dabbed away with long brushes. I took a closer look and could see that each piece of pottery had an outline. The workers kept paint in small bowls, or in some cases, shallow dishes, similar to those used in Chinese calligraphy, working with no more than a few colors at a time. The workers all sat on either side of a long table, one row of girls facing another. They worked quietly and at a leisurely pace, and I thought that the workroom had the feel of an art class. Off in a corner, away from the girls at the long tables, was a skinny boy who held a scalpel in his hand. We stopped for a moment and watched as he used the instrument to carve up a block of yellow foam. Having cut away a small piece, he blew off the synthetic crumbs and tested his work by dipping the block into an ink tray. He then pressed the block against a large sheet of paper, revealing the outline of a floral decoration. "This is the hardest job in the factory," Kevin said. "Not everyone is accurate." The foam blocks were used as a stamp to outline the designs that would be painted on the pottery pieces, and the images had to be created in reverse. It was impressive, and I started to remove a small digital camera from my bag. I thought sending pictures back to Howard might be a good idea. "Sorry," Kevin said. "Pictures are not allowed." Kevin was protective, as I would soon understand. He took me to his office and asked me to have a seat. On his desk were two computer screens from which he could see the entire factory floor. I took an interest in the system, and with the controls he showed me how he could change the camera angles and zoom in or out. He said it was important for him to stay on top of the workers, and he explained that his employees were not allowed to leave the premises. Many factories had such policies in place, but Kevin went even further by holding the identification cards of his employees for additional protection. "Why all the security?" I asked. We have many secrets, Kevin said. There were other things that he did to maintain control. He explained that in his factory, no more than 1/4 of the workers ever came from a single province. When too many workers came from the same place, he said, groups were more willing to conspire. Another trick of his was to hire more workers than necessary. When there was enough work for everyone, the workers felt that they were needed and were more inclined to make demands on management. When there wasn't enough work, employees tried harder to prove their worth. Kevin asked me to follow him to his showroom. The styles of the pottery pieces there did not match. While some of the pieces struck me as American in style, others seemed more European or possibly even Middle Eastern. The mix of styles made the factory's collection of samples look something like a rummage sale. A delivery was in progress, and Kevin turned his attention to the arriving workers. There were 3 of them, and they carried in a number of samples that included vases as well as lamps. Kevin was drawn to one object, a brass-colored lamp. He inspected it immediately, and then, moving its tag out of the way, he took a picture of it. I asked Kevin if the delivery workers were his employees. He gave me a mischievous look. No, they are my spies. As he said this, he looked at me carefully, gauging my reaction, as he had done earlier when he told me that he was from Los Angeles. Kevin explained that he had all sorts of people combing the area for samples. There were so many factories all clustered together that it made such activities possible. I imagined that workers on the inside of some factories might have snuck out samples for a small fee, or maybe the samples were taken right off the trucks before they left for export. New designs were valuable to Kevin. If he saw a design that he liked, he took a picture and sent it off to customers. If an order was placed, he could consider asking another factory to produce it, or he could simply copy the product himself. He was not at all that interested in producing electrical items, he said, so the lamp was something he would outsource. I had never met anyone quite like Kevin. He was charming in a devilish way, and he was a sharper breed. He was defensive in keeping his workers behind a high wall because he did not want his secrets leaked out, yet he aggressively sought to acquire the secrets of his competitors. Copying was rampant in China, and this made manufacturers behave in strange ways. One manufacturer that I ran into produced shoes with designs borrowed from Europe. In China, the company worried that competitors would rob them of these newly acquired designs. Factory employees were given the chance to buy a pair of the shoes they made at a discounted rate, but they were not allowed to take the shoes out of the factory for a full year, not until that shoe's design was more generally known to the marketplace. In China, Kevin's behavior was understood, and most people would have said that he was wise to be cautious. And for aggressively seeking out the original designs of others, some would have called him clever. What did his factory sell anyway but sand and water, covered with paint and glaze? Any number of factories in the area could have made the same product at the same price, if not for less. As it turned out, the problem with Howard, my frantic client, was that he had no proprietary designs of his own. Other importers from the United States were sending over interesting new samples, and Kevin was anxious to get hold of those. Kevin said that he would like to help Howard, but that he was in a tough spot. He could not sell proprietary designs that came from American importers to others who were also from the United States. He would not say so, but I had the feeling that some of those designs might be available for sale if only Howard had been from another market instead. In the end, Kevin said that he could only provide Howard with product from his warehouse. Some of the designs were out of date, but they would suit Howard's product line. What choice do I have? Howard told me. I'm running out of stock. I inspected the pottery on a later visit, and based on the amount of dust on the pieces, I figured they had been in the warehouse for 2 or 3 years. The items had all been made for other importers, and on the bottom of the pieces were barcodes made for specific retailers. One was for TJ Maxx, a major retail chain. If these styles were no longer in fashion, I thought, then TJ Maxx might not mind that they were being sold by their Chinese supplier, but then what was the benefit to a customer like Howard if he purchased out-of-fashion merchandise? The worst part about the pottery that Kevin wanted to sell was that the prices listed were high. An importer like Howard should have been paying about 1/4 of retail, but he was paying closer to 50%. Howard was probably paying more than what he would have paid when TJ Maxx marked the product down in an end-of-season closeout sale. Importers that provided original designs were quoted low prices by Chinese manufacturers. They were offered a bargain in part because smaller importers paid more. Watching as some of Kevin's factory workers packed up boxes for Howard, I noticed that some of the pieces were even defective, and I had an uneasy feeling about Howard's business prospects. Howard was disappointed but resigned. He did not have the volume to justify hiring someone to design original pieces, and therefore he felt at the mercy of the manufacturer. Howard also reiterated that he was in a hurry and that he needed to take whatever he could get. We loaded Howard's product and shipped it overseas. Another few shipments later, Howard ran into trouble. As expected, his prices were too high. An importer of ceramics couldn't purchase product for only half of its retail price and survive. Kevin knew it, but pushed for the higher prices anyway. Larger customers got discounts. Smaller customers paid more. It was how business worked in China, and as I would later come to understand, this was an economically efficient business model for Chinese manufacturers. Big customers got discounts, not just because they brought in volume, but because they provided fresh designs. These were later turned out to smaller importers who were given the squeeze on price.